Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we are tackling a really big topic, human rights, something we hear about all the time, but often in a, well, kind of vague way, wouldn't you say?
Definitely. It carries huge moral weight, but the specifics can get fuzzy.
Exactly. So we want to move past just the philosophical ideas, you know, the ideals, and really analyze the concrete legal and political structure that actually gives human rights their force. And we're using Andrew Clapham's major work as our guide here.
Yeah, and that's the crucial bit Clapham really hammers home. When we talk human rights, it's easy to think, oh, moral goals or nice declarations. But he insists they're way more solid than that.
Just so.
They are legally binding entitlements, real enforceable claims. They actually form the backbone of modern international law, placing specific serious obligations on states.
Okay, so why dive into the legal nitty-gritty now? Why is that perspective so critical today? Can't we just talk about the ethics?
Well, the ethics are vital, of course, but the legal framework is how you hold power accountable. Understanding the treaties, the courts, the monitoring bodies, that's the toolkit you need to analyze today's challenges.
Like what sort of challenges?
Think about it, globalization, massive migration shifts, the incredible power of multinational corporations. These things are constantly testing the system. The legal framework, even as it evolves, is what allows us to demand accountability in this really complex world. It's practical.
Got it. And the person giving us this map, this toolkit, is Andrew Clapham. He's professor of public international law at the Graduate Institute in Geneva. But this isn't just some dusty academic text, right?
No, not at all. That's what makes his view so valuable, I think. He wears two hats, essentially. He's a rigorous academic, absolutely top-tier theorist.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also spent a lot of time in the trenches, you could say, as a practical advisor and advocate. He's worked directly with the UN, with the ICRC, the Red Cross, with lots of human rights groups.
Ah, okay. So he doesn't just know the theory from the library.
Yeah.
He actually understands the real-world pressures,
mm-hmm.
where things get stuck.
Precisely. He gets the mechanics. He knows how the system is supposed to work, where it often fails, you know, because of politics, and where it actually manages to succeed. He bridges that gap between the beautiful words in a declaration and the, well, the messy reality of treaty negotiations and court cases.
Right. So Clapham's book, his work, is really about demystifying this whole complex area. It's like a comprehensive guide. It traces the idea of human rights way back, doesn't it?
Yeah, from ancient ideas of natural law through the Enlightenment thinking about individual dignity right up to the system we have now, which was really forged after World War II.
And the core argument, the main thesis.
It really centers on this idea he calls dynamic universality. It sounds a bit academic, but the concept is crucial.
Okay, break that down for us. Dynamic universality.
Okay, so Clapham argues human rights need to have two qualities that seem almost contradictory. First, they must be universally applicable. They apply to everyone, everywhere, because they're about inherent human dignity. But second, they also need to be dynamic, constantly evolving, and sensitive to culture.
Hmm. Universal and culturally sensitive. That sounds like a tightrope walk.
Mm.
How does that actually work? How do you keep something universal but also adapt it?
Well, the key is fighting back against the idea that fundamental principles, say gender equality or the ban on torture, are just Western ideas that can be dismissed locally. Universality means those core standards are non-negotiable.
Okay.
But the way you implement them, the specific laws or programs, can and should be sensitive to local contexts and cultures. So universality doesn't mean rigid uniformity in practice.
Right. And the dynamic part means the system has to keep up with new challenges, like digital privacy or AI ethics,
yeah.
Things they couldn't have imagined in 1948.
Exactly. New realities demand new interpretations or even new rights frameworks. So Clapham's overall goal is to equip you, the reader, with both the concepts, the what, and the practical knowledge, the how. So you can critically engage, understand when rights are being upheld, and importantly, when they're being violated.
Okay, let's dig into that legal architecture then.
Yeah.
You mentioned post-World War II being key. Before 1945, how a country treated its own people was pretty much its own business, right? That was the idea of absolute state sovereignty.
Yeah, that was the dominant view. But Clapham argues the sheer horror of the war created this global consensus that, well, that absolute sovereignty had gone too far. That protective wall around the state had to be breached when it came to fundamental rights.
So it was a moral shift, but then it got locked in legally.
Exactly. It started with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the UDHR, in 1948, a landmark document, hugely influential. But, and this is important, it wasn't initially a legally binding treaty itself. It set the standard, the common aspiration.
Okay, so if the UDHR was the aspiration, what gave the system actual legal teeth? What really started limiting state sovereignty in practice?
That came a bit later, in 1966, with two major legally binding treaties. Now, there was a political reason they were split, mainly Cold War politics.
The ideological divide.
Right. So you got the ICCPR, that's the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and then the ICSCR, the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. These are the big ones. States that sign and ratify them are legally bound. Together with the UDHR, they form the International Bill of Human Rights. And that truly made how a state treats its citizens a matter of legitimate international concern.
And that split, ICCPR and ICSCR, highlights a classic distinction Clapham discusses. Negative versus positive rights. Let's unpack that.
Sure. The civil and political rights, the ones in the ICCPR, are often thought of as negative rights. This basically means they require the state to refrain from doing certain things. Like, the state must not torture you. It must not arbitrarily arrest you. It must not prevent you from speaking freely or practicing your religion. It's about freedom from state interference.
Okay, freedom from. Whereas the economic, social, and cultural rights in the ICSCR, those seem different. They sound like they require the government to actually do stuff, maybe spend money.
Exactly. Those are generally called positive rights. They require the state to take active measures, to use its resources, to ensure things like the right to health, the right to education, the right to an adequate standard of living.
And Clapham really pushes back against ranking these, doesn't he? He argues they're indivisible and interdependent.
Absolutely. He totally rejects any hierarchy, like the old Cold War idea that political rights were somehow more important than, say, having enough food or access to healthcare.
Makes sense. I mean, what good is the right to vote if you're starving or too sick to leave your bed?
Precisely. True dignity requires both. However, because these positive rights often require significant state resources and action, their implementation often comes with this concept of progressive realization.
Okay, progressive realization. That sounds like important legal jargon we need to translate. What does it mean in practice?
Right. It doesn't mean states can just ignore these rights because they're expensive or difficult. It means they have an immediate obligation to start taking steps using the maximum available resources towards fully realizing those rights.
So it's not an overnight fix, but they have to be actively working on it. Demonstrably.
Yes. Think of it like building a national healthcare system. A country might not be able to provide top-tier care to everyone immediately, especially a developing country. But under progressive realization, it must have a plan, commit resources, and show continuous concrete improvements over time towards that goal. It's about commitment and measurable progress.
Got it. Okay, so moving beyond rights that belong primarily to individuals, Clapham also talks about group rights, things like the right to self-determination for peoples or specific rights for indigenous communities and minorities.
Mm-hmm. And this connects directly to another huge modern challenge, globalization and the role of non-state actors.
How so?
Because historically, human rights law focused almost entirely on the relationship between the individual and their state. The state had the obligations, but now...
Now you have these massive multinational corporations, MNCs, that operate across borders, sometimes with more economic power than small countries.
Exactly. Their decisions about supply chains, labor practices, environmental impact can affect rights in dozens of places simultaneously. So international law has had to adapt. It can't just point the finger at governments anymore.
So responsibility is spreading horizontally, not just vertically from the state.
That's a good way to put it. Frameworks like the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights have emerged. They spell out that corporations have a responsibility to respect human rights, to conduct due diligence to make sure their operations aren't causing harm.
Even if the local government in a particular country isn't enforcing its own laws very well.
Yes. The idea is, if a company benefits from operating somewhere or from a certain supply chain, it has a responsibility to ensure rights are protected within its sphere of influence. It's a major shift. Which brings us to maybe the trickiest part, enforcement. Okay, a state signs a treaty, promises to uphold these rights. What happens if it doesn't? Clapham is realistic here. There's no global police force, no single world human rights court with universal jurisdiction.
Right. It's more of a complex web, isn't it? A lot of monitoring, reporting, and the famous naming and shaming.
That's a big part of it. You have bodies like the UN Human Rights Council, which conducts periodic reviews of states' records. You have treaty bodies that monitor compliance with specific conventions. And crucially, you have special rapporteurs.
Who are they exactly?
They're independent experts appointed by the UN to investigate specific themes like torture or freedom of speech or the situation in specific countries. They visit, they gather evidence, they write detailed reports. These reports carry significant weight. They create an official record and generate international pressure.
And then there are the regional systems, which sometimes have more teeth, like the European Court of Human Rights.
Yes, the regional courts, particularly the European one, are often seen as the strongest model because they can issue legally binding judgments against member states. They can order states to change laws, pay compensation to victims. That provides a direct remedy for individuals in a way the global UN system often can't. It's a multi-layered system with different levels of enforcement power.
Okay, let's pull back a bit and look at the big picture themes Clapham emphasizes. One you mentioned earlier is that constant tension, universality versus cultural relativism. How does he resolve that?
His core message is that universal principles must hold firm. Things like inherent dignity, non-discrimination, the prohibition of torture are non-negotiable. But the way these principles are put into practice, the specific legal mechanisms or social programs, can and should be sensitive to local cultural contexts. Universality provides the essential floor, the minimum standard, but it doesn't demand identical implementation everywhere.
So, universal principles, culturally sensitive application. Got it. Another huge theme relevant to so many international debates is that sovereignty is not an absolute shield.
Yeah, this is fundamental to the post-WWII order. A state can't just hide behind the wall of sovereignty and say, how we treat our people is nobody else's business when mass atrocities or systematic violations are happening. International law now recognizes a legitimate basis for international scrutiny and sometimes even intervention in those extreme cases.
We also touch on the indivisibility of rights. He really argues against seeing political rights as somehow superior to economic or social rights.
He does. He insists that true human dignity requires the whole spectrum. Fighting poverty isn't just good policy. It's fulfilling the human right to an adequate standard of living. Ensuring access to education isn't just about social mobility. It's about the right to education. They're all interconnected. You diminish one, you diminish them all.
And finally, he stresses that human rights aren't just legal technicalities for lawyers. They function best as a tool for social justice.
Right. Their real power often comes when grassroots movements, activists, and ordinary citizens use the language and framework of human rights to demand change, to hold governments accountable, to push for social justice from the ground up. The legal framework provides the leverage.
Clapham has some really concise ways of capturing these core ideas. Let's touch on a few memorable concepts.
Yeah, one really fundamental one reframes where rights even come from.
You mean the idea that human rights are not gifts from the state? They are legal entitlements that precede the state and set limits on its power.
Exactly. They're not favors granted by politicians that can be taken away. They are inherent pre-existing claims that people hold, and their purpose is actually to constrain state power.
That's powerful. And it connects to his focus on real-world impact, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. He says something like, "The true measure of a human rights system is not the beauty of its declarations, but the protection it provides to the most vulnerable members of society."
So forget the fancy words on paper. Look at what's actually happening to people on the margins.
Precisely. It's about outcomes, not just intentions or pronouncements.
And there's a warning, too, about weakening the whole concept.
Yes. This one is really important for anyone working in advocacy or even just discussing these issues. The greatest threat to human rights today is not their rejection, but their trivialization through overuse and misapplication.
What does he mean by trivialization?
He means if we start labeling every single policy disagreement or minor grievance as a human rights violation, the term loses its meaning and its power. We need to be precise, to reserve that language for serious deprivations of fundamental rights. Otherwise, the whole framework gets diluted and loses its moral and legal force.
That makes sense. Maintain the gravity. Okay, so bringing this all together, how can understanding Clapham's framework be practically useful for, you know, someone just trying to be an informed citizen.
Well, think about how you read the news. When you see reports about the UN Human Rights Council or a special rapporteur's findings or debates about sanctions, knowing this legal architecture gives you a lens. You understand the context, the mandate, what these bodies are trying to achieve. It lets you evaluate your own government's actions or political candidate stances from a much more informed, rights-based perspective.
And it's not just for international stuff, right? You can apply this locally.
Absolutely. Think about local issues, maybe debates in your community about homelessness, access to quality schools, or fair policing. You can use the language and principles of economic and social rights, or rights to non-discrimination and security of person to frame those local concerns. It connects your community struggles to internationally recognized standards, which can give local advocacy campaigns more weight and legitimacy.
So it provides a kind of universal language for justice.
In a way, yes. For me, the biggest takeaway is that human rights aren't some abstract utopia, nor are they just dry legal documents. They are a living, breathing, practical process. It's an ongoing struggle that requires constant vigilance and active participation, not just from lawyers and diplomats, but from everyone. The system is there, but it needs people to push for it to work.
Yeah, I agree. I think the real value of Clackham's work is how he manages to blend that deep legal knowledge with real-world practical wisdom. It doesn't just tell you about human rights. It kind of empowers you with the knowledge of the actual tools that exist to fight injustice and uphold dignity, both globally and right in your own backyard.
And maybe a final thought for you, the listener, to reflect on. Think about the absolute prohibition of torture. It's non-derogable, meaning states cannot legally justify it, ever, not even in a time of war or national emergency. Consider how holding on to that one single absolute standard, even under immense pressure, reflects the underlying strength and perhaps the necessary resilience of the entire human rights project.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.